Hello everyone and welcome to an airline pilot podcast from Flight Level 320. This is a podcast all about aviation and flight simulation, hosted by myself, 320 Sim Pilot, a real world airline pilot, flight simmer and YouTuber. I'll be joined by other pilots and experienced flight simmers as we discuss all things aviation and flight sim, answer questions from the community and chat about what it's like to take some of these incredible machines into the sky. This is from Flight Level 320. To start today's episode, I'm going to answer a question about my channel, which I received from the community, and discuss its origins. This is something I wanted to talk about as we've now passed 3 years of the 320 Sim Pilot channel. After that, we'll be joined once again by Barney, an avid flight simmer, real-world airline captain, and VATSIM controller, to answer some more of your questions. We'll be talking about landing performance, real-life approaches versus Microsoft Flight Simulator, and decide if we can relax as passengers or do we second-guess everything going on. We'll also take a look at the recent strong winds in the UK and discuss how that impacts us as professional airline pilots. As always, thank you all so much for your feedback and kind words about the podcast. To ask questions, as usual, you can ask them on the 320 SimPilot Discord, or you can email me at simpilot320@hotmail.com. All views expressed are our own. They do not represent those of our employers. Please keep up spreading the word about the podcast. It makes all the difference and enables me to bring you special content and interviews, speaking of which, we have a special guest in the next episode, so stay tuned to find out who. Our first question for today's episode comes from Leo, who asks, what made you want to start with making flight simulation videos? So I thought this would be a good moment to talk about the channel. It's been 3 years of the 320 Sim Pilot channel now, which is quite a hard fact to come to terms with, really. I cannot believe it's been that long. I originally made the first videos on the channel, and I have the date here. The first video was 5th of April 2020, and I made it using the TOLIS A321, which had recently come out for XPaint 11. Now, why did I decide to make that first video? Well, once the pandemic started and I stopped flying, it was the first time in my working life as a professional that I hadn't been always at work, always engaged with the job and with the aeroplanes. I previously used flight simulation a lot, especially growing up and then also again in some later years. And I mainly used Flight Simulator X. That was the last simulator I had used, although I had dabbled with X-Plane 10 briefly when I was looking at specifically the 757. That was a very detailed 757 I wanted to try out. Now, I always struggled with flight simulation when I was younger with some surprisingly basic things. I remember when I started out on the 757 in FSX, the Captain Sim one, I struggled with the FMC and being able to clear a discontinuity, as it were. An incredibly easy thing to do, but not obvious, and I didn't really know where to look to find out that information. And YouTube wasn't as big back then. There weren't endless tutorials, and there wasn't the information available as easily as it is now. I then got the Aerosoft Airbus for Flight Simulator X, and I couldn't turn on the engines, couldn't figure out how to do that. It felt slightly different to the Boeings, and for some reason I couldn't figure it out, although it was, of course, remarkably simple. So all of this came together, and then when the pandemic started, I thought, well, I enjoy the idea of flight simulation videos, and I now know quite a lot about the Airbus. Now, I'm not saying I know more than anybody else. I'm just saying I'm now experienced on the aircraft and have spent a lot of time with it, so perhaps I could help some people enjoy their simulation of it. And TOLIS at the same time had released the A321, and that seemed like a really detailed add-on, and I was interested to try it out, really, having also not used the 321 very much in any simulator. I'm a big fan of the Airbus, so it also gave me a chance to sort of talk about something I enjoy, something I'm interested in, and something that I enjoy working on. So I went and got hold of the XPlane 11 and the TOLIS, tried it out, and made that first video, which is a walk-around video where I just walk around the outside of the model. Now, it is interesting to see how far we've come in those 3 years in flight simulation, because Flight Simulator, to me, felt like it had very much stagnated over the years before that. And I don't mean any particular flight sim. I mean, there just hadn't been much on the market and it wasn't changing so much. Whereas now we've gone from X-Plane 11 to obviously Microsoft Flight Simulator and X-Plane 12, where there's been a significant advancement in the detail we get on the models, especially the visual models in Microsoft Flight Simulator are remarkable, even by comparison to that first walk-around video when I look back at it. But yeah, that was where I ended up making those videos. And I made the first video, and then I made another one where I show you a cold and dark setup, and then I went through the basic things, you know, which we're all familiar with now, such as the setting up of the FMGC, turning on the aircraft, starting the engines, and I went through the whole flight like that. Whilst I was doing that, I then got into the idea of trying out VATSIM, something I'd also never successfully managed to do when I was younger. And I felt that now I had experience with real world flying and air traffic control, that I'd have a chance at getting away with flying on VATSIM if I could just figure out how to log on. So I put a bit of effort in, did my first flight on VATSIM and uploaded that as a video. All the while, I started to get comments, even from those first videos, from people in the community who were being very kind, really enjoyed the videos, which was very humbling considering, you know, we're talking about videos that were getting next to no views, of course, just a few views. But the people who did view seemed to enjoy them and commented some very nice things, which really engaged me to keep going. And they would ask things like, well, what do I do with this? Or how would you do this? Or can you make a video about that? So that is what motivated me to keep going with them and keep making different videos. The channel then grew a little bit and we started to have a bit of a community and regulars who would show up to the videos. And then we asked about a Discord. So we started a Discord. And also, of course, the question about live streaming came up. So I did my first live stream, which came shortly after that. And that was quite a nerve-wracking moment. That was a big moment for me. So the live stream, which I obviously got to grips with and thoroughly enjoyed once I got warmed up a little bit into it. Then we started to deal with Microsoft Flight Simulator, and of course we had our breakout video when I did my Microsoft Flight Simulator first look. That was in 18th of August 2020. It's now got over 600,000 views. Some other key moments for the channel would be the 787, Learn to Fly the 787 video I did on the Heavy Division. That's got 456,000 views. That went up in June 2021. So also, hard to believe, it's been almost a year since the first Phoenix Simulations videos. The channel now has 73,000 subscribers, or over that, 9.1 million total views and over 1.6 million hours watch time. I just want to thank you all so much for being a part of the channel. It's really, really humbling and I absolutely have thoroughly enjoyed it. As I hope I've made clear from this little discussion, the main reason I still make videos on the channel and still do the streams is because I enjoy engaging with you all about flight simulation and aviation. I have moved the focus of the channel a little bit at the moment. You can see that I tend to do things like fly different aircraft and different routes now, as I'm trying to sort of expand out, because we've covered so much of the Airbus and we've done several different Airbuses as well, that I really enjoy spending my time exploring the world of aviation with you all and the actual world itself in Microsoft Flight Simulator. So that is where we've got the channel to today, but it all comes from all of you and your engagement, and that is the ultimate motivation behind the channel. So I just really want to express my thanks to you all for being so enthusiastic and coming along and being a part of the 320 Sim Pilot community here. I really, really do appreciate it. Now we're going to move on to question two, and we're going to introduce, of course, or bring back into the room Barney. So I hope you enjoy the rest of the podcast. Right, so now we're moving on to question two, and welcome back to the show, Barney. Thanks for joining us again.
Hello, yeah, it's great to be here. I'm liking being another familiar voice within the community.
That's it now, yeah. You're getting your opinions heard, which is always fun. We're not in a studio sort of situation again this time, but we are once again doing this remotely, but that's just because of trying to get schedules to line up is obviously quite tricky, which is something I get asked a lot, what some compromises that being an airline pilot has, and certainly getting yourself into the same room or pub as friends can be tricky. And this is sort of proving that, but there we go. So thank you for taking the time out today.
That's all right.
So
I love it.
This next question is from Stuart, and Stuart asks, are we obliged to do a landing performance calculation on every flight, or are we allowed to take our experience and decide if that means we're going to fit onto a runway for landing?
Interesting question. Yes, we do do it. Yeah, we do it every landing, really, just to make sure that it is going to work. It's a really good question. I think the problem with it is it seems a bit stupid when you're landing a light 319 into a 4 kilometer runway, but it's always worth doing because it creates a habit.
Yeah.
And habits which improve safety are always beneficial.
Yeah, that's it. It's fine to think that you know, and you know, I can tell you the stopping distance of a 320 with low water brake and medium water brake on a dry runway, sort of most reasonable weights, something like, and you wouldn't be familiar with this, you know, medium water brake, 1800 meters, low water brake, 2300 meters, you know? So
yeah,
you can take that and then you could look at an airport chart and go, oh, well, the runway is 3000 meters long, so that's fine. Problem with that is, of course,
where's the inset threshold? Does the runway slope down or up? And what if it's wet? And where's the intersection that you want to come off at? So it can all add up much quicker. And there's some airports that we fly to that I think some people assume one thing's going to work and then they calculate it. And then they realize, oh, actually, it doesn't. And there's like certain airports I fly to that's a theme. I think that people have a different idea in their mind about how long it is. So, all of these things are reasons that we just do a calculation every time. It's also assumed in the flight planning stage. So some airlines do this differently. Some airlines will do a performance check as part of the flight plan, and that will be given to the pilots. So it will say what weight you're expected to land at and if that fits into the airport. And others won't show that to the pilots, but it will be assumed that if the runway is dry, that you can land there. And if it's wet or anything, then you need to do another calculation. So there are different ways of doing this. But ultimately, it's our responsibility. So why would you ever put yourself in that situation? And
I think the other problem, sorry, carry on.
No, go on.
No, I was just going to say the other thing is, you spend a lot of time in this job trying to cover yourself and thinking, if I was to justify what I've done in court, for example, if God forbid something happened, the first thing they're going to turn around and say, if you, for instance, slide off the side of the runway or roll off the end of the runway, even if it's nothing to do with the fact that the landing performance was incorrect, or if we'll say, why didn't you do an IFLD, an in-flight landing distance calculation? And you're not going to be able to sit there and go, oh, because I knew it was okay, because a lawyer would tear you apart. So it's,
there's a professional responsibility, and as a passenger, you would expect the pilots to have some firm evidence that they're going to fit on the runway. And when it's a really long runway, you can see that experience is going to tell you it's fine. But there is that, where's that line that it becomes a runway where you need to do a performance calculation? And that line will be different for everybody. And that's what we can't have, that sort of variability, because then you're going to have different ideas from different people. And what we need is the actual numbers, the hard numbers. So it's much easier just to always have an idea. Brings on to my next question, which is from Wired Womble, who asks, how do you choose your autobrake selection?
Good name.
Yes, good. how do you choose your autobrake selection? So medium for getting off the runway quicker, or would you go low to reduce brake wear? And that sort of ties into this whole working out your landing distance, because you need to know where you're trying to come off the runway as well. So that's
exactly
a big thing in choosing autobrake for me. I don't know about you, Barney.
Yeah, I'd agree. So I think trying to plan your exit. I think on short haul it's not as critical, but on the bigger aircraft I know that it can be. It's more critical trying to plan like brake wear, brake cooling.
Yeah.
I think even on the 7-3 they are very conscious of the brake cooling times.
Yeah.
So does
it not
I
have fans?
Would...
There's no 7-3s don't have fans.
No, there's
they?
Not. I don't think they do. No.
I've never heard of it.
Oh, sorry. No, I don't think they do have fans. I suppose you could use, if there was a brake cooling issue, you'd probably land with more flap and full reverse, which would then reduce the brake temperatures.
Yeah.
There's lots of different ways of doing it, really.
I've flown aircraft without brake fans, the Dash 8 didn't have brake fans either. The Dash 8 didn't even have brake temperature sensors,
really?
Yeah, it's a thing where you can, it's in the Airbus, if you're going, and you probably have seen this, if you don't have temperature sensors working, you can still go, but then you have energy charts and you have to work out how much energy is being put into the brakes on landing. Yeah. And then there's a certain cool down time and you can reduce that drastically by running the brake fans. But if you can't use brake fans, you have to just sit there for like 2.5 hours while the brakes, you know, cool off the supposed energy that went into them. And those energy charts,
it's amazing how hot
runway
they get.
It is. And so this will all be factored in. So if you want to have like if you've got a short turnaround, then you might want to keep the brakes cooler. Then like you say, you'd go flat full, and you might even use max reverse if you can, if that's an option at your airport, just to reduce the brake temperatures.
Yeah.
Brake wear, it's slightly harder to get right. Brake wear is a strange thing on the carbon brakes that the Airbus has. They work really well with one application, but if you keep applying the brakes, lots of successive applications, then it just sort of shaves off the brake discs and you wear them down really quickly. So brakeware,
even on taxiing,
exactly. Taxiing is where you can use a lot of brakeware. If you use the auto brake on landing, it's really good because it's just one application, and then that heats up the brakes, and then they that's where they perform best. But when they're cold and you're taxiing out and you're just constantly applying them, then that's where they can wear out. So trying to get that right is a big thing for brakeware. But yeah, so in terms
absolutely.
Of answering that question, how do you choose your auto brake selection? It's a combination of firstly, obviously, stopping distance on the runway. Is it a short runway? Then that's going to settle it. You're going to need medium or maybe even maximum manual. And then after that, we start thinking about, well, where are we going to vacate the runway? Which brake setting will work best for that? Is it a busy airport? So which brake setting will get me off the runway quickest? I.e., let's say you're in a really long airport. I don't know, you're landing in like Amsterdam. Then you want to get yourself off the runway fairly quickly. Low auto brake is going to work to get you, you know, 1.8 right. You want to need to get way down it, don't you? But there's other airports like maybe Gatwick where it's busy and you might want to get off at an earlier exit to get yourself out of the way. So you might use medium. So all of these things get taken into account. And that calculation just helps us figure out where we're going to sit with all of that.
The other interesting thing with brakes are quite an interesting topic, even though you just think they wouldn't be.
I know. It's like everything with aeroplanes. We can get a good few hours out of the brakes, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. But as just short quickly, is that with the brakes, when you so the braking technique for all commercial aircraft is let it get up to speed, like 20, 25 knots, apply the brakes gently, bring it right down to between 5 and 10 knots, and then let it roll again, which is a bit counterintuitive because you're like, you want to sort of keep the speed where it is, but you don't. You want to sort of let it roll up, slow down, let it roll up, slow down. And on like the long haul Boeing aircraft, for instance, every application of the brakes will alternate which wheels it brakes, so it evenly heats the wheels up, which is quite cool. Yeah.
Especially there's a lot more wheels.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
Very clever.
So that's going back to the whole, well, you're not trying to keep the temperatures low in that case, really, are you? In fact, you're trying to get them up a little bit. Like the reason, because if you accelerate, so in the Airbus, we go up to sort of 30 knots, don't we? And then decelerate. And as you do that, that obviously heats up the brakes more than if you were to just keep using the brakes to keep your speed at sort of 10 knots. Because by going to 30 and then decelerating, they warm up. But when they warm up, they get more efficient and they stop wearing out as quickly. So it's actually quite a good place to get them. They'd also stop a lot better, I think. You know, having the brakes at 150 degrees, 200 degrees on takeoff, I don't think that's a bad thing, because you're going to then find that the airplane will grip very quickly. Because parking, if you ever park with really hot brakes after like a short landing in a hot destination, have you ever noticed that as you try and park on stands, the brakes become really grippy? And as soon as you try and apply them,
they just
grab. Yeah. Are those, when they're like sort of 400 degrees plus after a really hot landing, they are, that's where they love to be. They're just so good. There is obviously a point where they won't be able to absorb any more energy and you'll get brake fade, but I think that's quite high temperature on these carbon brakes, but I don't know what the limits are. We need an engineer now as a guest, a brake engineer.
Yeah, it's where we're going into physics.
Just making it up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There we go.
It's all magic.
Yeah, there we go. Great. Okay. Next question comes from Mike P, who asks, with one engine getting more use with things like single engine operations and taxi, does maintenance even this out? Speaking of not knowing what we're talking about,
yes, I suppose they do. They would do, yeah, because the engines have to be evenly aged, I believe. Anyway,
well, on an aircraft, they're evenly aged.
On an aircraft, yeah, I believe they try and they balance them out, because if you put a brand new engine on it, I can't remember what it is actually. That's a really good question. I know that on the 777, for example, you can single engine taxi on either engine, so it's not, you alternate them, so it's not too much of an issue. But on the 320, I'm not 100% sure.
So for those of you who aren't aware, when we taxi out or in after, before takeoff and after landing in the A320, it's quite common. Airlines all over the world now will use just one engine to taxi along and then start up the other engine before takeoff as they get nearer to the runway, and then they'll shut it down after landing and taxi in on one engine. It saves fuel, it saves engine wear. And talking about brakes, it saves brake wear, because the Airbus tries to actually run away. It's got too much power at idle. So when you release the brakes, it just tries to roll forwards. So by shutting down one engine, we reduce that and we reduce the brake wear. And obviously the carbon emissions and everything else. It's a really good question. I genuinely don't know. And it's something I want to look into. I'm going to see if I can find someone who does know, because I don't actually have access to that information.
Really good question. Yeah.
Yeah. The technical log on the aircraft, they don't go back that far. Well, they do, but we don't see the full technical log and the details of how long the engines have been on. You do notice on aircraft, I've certainly noticed, you can have two engines that look very different. So you can have two engines that, and one of them's got, it looked brand new, you know, and the other one doesn't. So I think even if they try and keep them similar in terms of age, I'm pretty sure they just get to different ages and get replaced when they need to. I don't feel like there's any limit. I don't think it's not like changing your tires on a car where you'll change the set at the same time, you know, you'll change both the rears or whatever. It seems to be that the engines can be different ages, because you'll notice as well on some aircraft different numbers. So the Airbus engines will try and run at the same EPR. That's what they're based on, engine pressure ratio. Or the same N1. But to do that, they'll put in whatever fuel flow they need independently. They've got their own FADEC, their own digital computers running that. So you'll notice different numbers and different EGTs and different N2 speeds and so on until they get the right EPR or N1 that they're looking for, which I assume comes down to the age of the engine and wear. But yeah, it's a good question. Because you're right.
That's a really good question. Yeah, maybe we'll have to look that up.
I wouldn't even know where. Because every flight, that one, the engine number one, which is the one that we taxi with on the Airbus, every flight that gets used probably 10 to 15 minutes more. Maybe a bit less, depending on if you're in a busy airport or not. But, you know, there could be 10 minutes, and that's every flight. And then it does sort of 8 flights in a day, maybe less, 6, 7, 8 flights. So you're looking at 80 minutes extra runtime a day. It adds up, I imagine.
Right.
So I assume, there is a difference, and how they balance that out, I don't know. But that's interesting to hear that on some other aircraft, they might just use alternate engines. That would solve that problem. We don't do that on the Airbus because of the way the hydraulic systems are set up. So we use engine one because it powers the green hydraulic system, and then the yellow hydraulic system we can power with an electrical pump. But we don't have an electrical pump for the green system, so that's why we don't do it in reverse. It is possible to do it in reverse, but it's not as well set up for it and uses the PTU and all sorts.
Yeah.
There we go. So some questions are coming out now that we need to
very
to get
technical.
Some, some really technical questions. but there we go. So this question comes from Dan VB, who says, have you ever flown into an airport in Microsoft Flight Simulator and then in real life and had deja vu?
Ooh. So been flying in real life and had deja vu?
Yeah, i.e. you went there in simulator first and then saw it in real life and thought, oh yeah, this looks just like it did in the sim. That's what I think the question's getting at.
Yeah, all the time, because if I'm not being somewhere before, I'll generally try and maybe go fly it in flight sim if it's a bit more complicated, for example.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
Sometimes, yeah. Like, especially if I'm doing light aircraft stuff and I'm maybe not 100% familiar on the instrument approaches and stuff like that. But yeah, I'll definitely do that. Yeah.
And it's good in Microsoft Flight Simulator is very good for light general aviation because of that. Obviously the satellite imagery is so good. You can really get just an idea of, well, where is that town? Where is that road I need to turn inside and all of this stuff? And you get an idea of how quickly you reach it. And that's where I find 100%. Simulators at their best, sort of working out the pacing and the timing of things. So if you're flying into, I don't know, if you think of like a challenging sort of approach to make, I don't know, if you're approaching Madrid from the north and you're descending into it, it's quite a high energy approach. And to get it right, you know, if you've never been before, you might think, yeah, I could just fly it normally. Whereas, you know, if you've done it in a sim, you might realize actually it's really tight. We need to get the flaps out earlier, get the drag on before we go down.
Exactly.
But I've
and it's amazing how just looking at it for like half an hour before doing it is just fantastic. And even before going in the sim, when we do our sim checks, I find it so useful for that.
Really? See, I'm slightly different. For GA, I think it's great. I don't tend to. I might. I was trying to think really hard for this question if there's somewhere that I've flown in the sim first and then in real life. But I'm ironically not much of a visual learner, I don't think. So although I make these things as videos, I don't actually receive information so well from a video as I do sort of a set of instructions, like a briefing sheet for that airfield. That's where I do better. So I find that, and I'd also be very careful using a simulator to practice an approach, if that makes sense. Very careful. You've got to keep an open mind. I'm not saying it's anything wrong doing it, but there's this risk that, you know, when you're sat at home and you just do it on your own, you might not be focused on it as much as you would be when you're going to do it in the real world, obviously. And you're not going to have another professional sitting next to you. So you might miss something, but then you might not realize you missed it when you're doing it, practicing at home on your own, you know, sort of while you're having a cup of tea. And then you might think you've learned something that isn't true, if that makes sense, and then take that with you to do it for in real life. And it turns out to be completely wrong because you didn't realize you hadn't set the Q&H right or whatever, because you were just messing around in the simulator. So I'm aware of the importance of keeping a super open mind when you are going to go and do it in real life, even if you've done it in the simulator before. But that's a more serious take on that question.
Yeah, it's because I'm the opposite. I'm a visual learner. Like, yeah. I can read something, and if I read it and take it in, I can sometimes learn. But if I look at like a diagram or watch something, I can find I can learn it a lot easier. Like, it goes in. So that's quite interesting. And I think what I mean on like using it for flight sim is, like, say you're doing dual hydraulic failures. For me, it's just simple things like just, what would the ECAM look like? Could the status space look like? Obviously, you're going to react to the situation on the day, but I do find it quite useful learning it. But obviously, as you say, it's not going to be perfect, so you can't rely on it. And the instructor's not going to be happy to turn and say, "Oh, in the Phoenix A320, it did this." it's one of those where you're
that's the thing you can never say, is it? Oh, well, when I did this in flight simulator.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
that's something 100%. you just can't say, because it doesn't hold any weight. And I'm not trying to degrade the flight sim experience. I think it's amazing, and I think especially in Microsoft Flight Simulator, the visuals do capture and do give deja vu. But I would, in terms of actually using it as prep, I'm very careful. But to flip that question the other way around, I have gone to lots of places in real life and then flown them in Flight Simulator and had deja vu. And that's what I find so impressive. Yeah. I've said this before on streams, where like flying into Rome Fiumicino looks like flying into Rome Fiumicino. It doesn't look sort of like it. It looks just like it. And the same, flying into Geneva, flying into Gatwick, this stuff all looks, and the ground and the houses and the sort of houses and the color of the roofs. I don't know how they've done it, but it's amazing. It's so, so, so good that it gives me huge faith when I go somewhere I've never been. And I because I know the places I have been look so real in the sim.
Yeah.
They match my experience of it. I can believe that that's what it would look like to fly into Los Angeles or Seattle or Johannesburg, because why wouldn't it, if it works so well for so many places I've seen, assuming worldwide is as good as the European data they've got, which I don't see why it wouldn't be.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, I've been to Melbourne on holiday, and I remember looking at the window. We were in the back of a 350, I think it was, looking out the window. And then when I went to do it in Flight Simulator, you're like, yeah, that's what it looked like. Those buildings are in that place. And yeah, it's just incredible. Yeah. So I would say, yes, the simulator is good enough to give you deja vu. And if you were to fly somewhere in the simulator, just for a visual sort of feeling, I think to go there in real life would probably give you a similar feeling. Yeah. I can't see why it wouldn't. It's amazing.
Yeah, I'd 100% agree with that. It is incredible now.
Yeah. Great. Right. Moving on. Okay. So this last question for today comes from 1144 Lee. And hopefully I've got that username right. I just scribbled it down. But the question is, as a passenger, do you relax or do you sit there and second guess what's going on. So what do you think, Barney?
I don't second guess anything because I trust my colleagues and my professionalism and my colleagues around the world. But I definitely much prefer being in control than I do down the back.
Yeah.
I'm not scared or anything at all, but it's more of the fact that it's like a, you're like, oh, wonder what they're doing now, or oh, that's interesting, or like looking out, thinking like, oh, they put flaps out now. It's the littlest of things, but you're not second guessing them or judging them in any way. It's just literally like a, oh, that's cool. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. I'd say that. Yeah.
It's hard, isn't it? As a passenger, and it's, you're not the only person. I've spoken to other people in the past, some of who are pilots, and then they get very anxious as passengers. And I think it comes from knowing, it's that usual thing, isn't it? If you know a little bit, but not everything. So, you know a lot about flying, but you can't see the airspeed or the distance to the runway or the altitude because you haven't got any of that information. Yeah. So you're just sat in the back having to look out the window, and it can be quite a strange detachment from a job where we are usually so in control. We have to be by design. We are in total control. Yeah. We know all of those things at any one time. And if we don't, we fix it. And then suddenly you've got to sit in the 100%. Back not knowing any of that. But you do, like you say, you trust your colleagues to know what they're doing, obviously. But it can be hard to fully relax. I think so.
That's a really good question, though. Yeah.
And there's always in the back of your mind that idea of, you know, oh, well, what if they come out and say, right, we need a pilot?
You haven't had a gin and tonic.
Yeah, exactly. You want to make sure you're still useful. Yeah, it's quite hard. You can't second guessing what the other pilots are doing. You know, like a landing, let's say you're in the back and an aircraft lands, would you ever judge that landing or second guess it, or do you ever find yourself sitting there thinking, oh, well, I would have done this or that? What do you think?
No, I don't think so, because you never know what's going on in the flight deck. You never know what's happened. And I think I've done firmer landings that I would have been happy about. They're completely safe and absolutely fine, but we all have that pride feeling. So normally I'd be like, oh, that's a nice landing. Oh, they've nailed that.
Yeah.
But no, I wouldn't say I've experienced the thumpers, really. But I'm very sympathetic of what's
sympathetic. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
If it's a rough landing, then it could have been caused by loads of things, because I know that I've had landings that aren't so smooth caused by any number of excuses I can think of. So why can't I give that benefit of the doubt to them as well? And also, like you say, we don't know anything. We can't see how far down the touchdown zone we were. We can't see what the crosswind was. You know, all of this information we don't have. So judging from the back is absolutely hopeless. But it's a trap I think some people fall into.
Yes.
And it's a trap I see online where I really struggle with any judgment online of flight crew and pilots, because it's a profession that, you know, we hold so dear, and we work so hard to be so safe and professional. And then, you know, there's an incident and it's summed up in a paragraph wherever it's reported, with not even half the information, not even a tenth of the information, just the smallest little bit. And there'll be people ready to jump in and be like, right, this is what definitely happened. And it's just
exactly, yeah, the picture is, pilots.
Oh, yeah, the picture is just vast. If you look at any accident report over the last 50 years, you know, if a Wikipedia article on an accident will go on for pages and pages, because the contributing factors will be essays worth of information,
yes,
about how someone's day was, or how the rest in the hotel was, or the technical state of the aircraft, or the what was going on with the engineer that morning, or whatever else. There's so many things,
yeah.
And the idea that you can just sit there and in a few days after an incident have any idea what happened, but yeah, it's something you have to be really careful not to do. But that's not to say, if I've, like on the Airbus, there's a common thing on landing, which is if you're sat in the back of an Airbus and it lands in a crosswind, have you ever felt, I don't know if you noticed it, but you'll suddenly get shifted left and right after touchdown? So in the Airbus, I don't know how many people know this, in flight, if you use the flight sim version, but the Airbus is quite unique in that you can't slide your feet up onto the rudder pedals. And what I mean by that is, in most aircraft, and Bardo, you correct me if I'm wrong on this, and I think it's the same on the 73, you would land with your heels on the floor, pushing the rudder with your the ball of your foot, with your heels sliding on the floor.
The little arch.
And then when you want to brake, you'll slide your feet up and use the brakes. So you'd land using your heels on the floor. And the reason we do that is so that you're not interfering with the brakes when you shouldn't be, i.e. on takeoff or when you're trying to actually touch down. Then when you want to apply the brakes, you can slide your feet up and apply the brakes because they're toe brakes. So you squeeze forward with your toes on the pedals. But on the Airbus, you can't do that. The pedals are grippy. There's rubber on them. So you can't slide your feet up and down. So what you have to do is land with your feet fully on the pedals and take off with them fully on the pedals, which is quite a strange feeling. And a lot of pilots new to the Airbus find that quite odd and disconcerting because you lose
I've never looked at it differently because I've never done different. So that's interesting.
Ah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah. It's not intuitive at first. If you come from another airliner, so on the dash, we would slide our heels on the floor because you don't want to interfere with the brakes. But on the Airbus, the way the pedals are designed, you can't, it's not an issue. You don't really interfere with the brakes. They're very good pedals and toe brakes, but you can't slide your feet up and down. You have to just leave them up there, same for landing. So if somebody doesn't do that, they land in a crosswind with their heels a bit too far down, so they kick off the drift, they land, touch down, and then they need to move their feet up to get onto the brakes. And what happens is as they lift their feet off the pedals, the rudder relaxes and the back of the plane swings, and then they get their feet back on the pedals where they should be, and then the whole thing swings again. But that's terrible. That's me being very judgy, but it's something you can notice. I have noticed sitting in the back on like certain windy days. But you know, I say that, and maybe it was just the gust. You know, who knows? It's not fair to be too confident in your opinions when you weren't one of the two people sat on the flight deck, and they're the only people who really know what's going on. And even then, sometimes it's only the person at the controls who can really tell you. It can be quite a subjective experience. Is that the right word?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hard to get right. Talking as well about being a bit bad as a passenger. I know I'm going on a bit now, but we're talking about control of, you know, we're used to being in control and familiarity. And I find when I'm a passenger on a long haul aircraft, I'm more likely to second guess things because it's not things like landing and so on, but it's like, it's a different concept to me flying out over the ocean. So I don't really know much about it. So I find that a little more intimidating because I wouldn't do it in an Airbus typically. So, and I've never done it, never gone long distance like that.
That's
so
a good point. Yeah.
I'll give an example. I went on holiday and the aircraft we were flying from, we took off from Doha and we were meant to go south. And the airplane flew east for a long time. And it was to do with which countries I think we were supposed to be allowed to fly over. And I was quite unnerved at first. I was like, why are we going the complete wrong way? And of course, if I was familiar with that airport or that route, I would have known exactly why. It wouldn't have even fazed me for a second. But because the little map would show me where we were going. And I was like, we're still pointing the wrong way. Why are we going the wrong way?
it's funny. Really throwing you. Like, what are they doing?
Was really throwing me. Yeah. And it's all because I was paying too much attention because I wanted to know as much as I could about what was going on. Yeah. Whereas if I just let myself be a passenger, I might have found that more relaxing.
Absolutely.
Like everyone else on the airplane who was asleep. I'd sit there looking at the map, trying to work out where we're going.
Getting your charts out.
Yeah. They should have been here 3 minutes ago over this waypoint. Yeah, exactly.
Get your airband receiver.
Yeah. There we go. Great. Right. Moving on. Right, time for a little bit of what's going on in Flight Simulator world. So the Innybuilds JFK came out just before we recorded this. And there we go. No surprise, Barney has not only already got it, downloaded and flown it. Barney's flying it right now, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Yeah, it's taken off now. Absolutely fantastic scenery.
Is it good? What's so good about it?
It's just a really good representation down to the fact that the terminals, interiors have all been done. There's people walking around the terminal.
Do they have animated people?
Just fantastic. Yeah, in the terminal.
That's good.
As well.
That's good. I like
so
that.
So it's it's really cool. It's really nice because I don't know. X-Plane probably did have a good JFK, but I can't remember there being a well modeled JFK in the P3D world.
Right.
Please correct me if I'm wrong, but I
I never had P3D.
I
would have owned it.
Don't remember there being. I would have owned it. Yeah, sure. But I couldn't remember there wasn't a high quality JFK for some reason. But I and I have smashed it. Absolutely smashed it. They really are.
They're good at
really,
their scenes.
Really done themselves. Really done it well. So I'm really impressed with that. The only conflict, my GSX for some reason wasn't working 100% with it, but that's not a problem. I'm sure over time they'll sort that. And it's probably because I haven't updated GSX, but we'll see.
That's the thing. So many updates yeah. to do, isn't it? Trying to keep on top of your simulator yeah. now. It's getting really hard.
And there's so many different apps that you can run, like Orbix and INI Manager and whatever, Flight Beam Manager and all these. I want them yeah. all in one place. It's like all the streaming services, isn't it? Netflix, iPlayer.
But I do like having Microsoft Flight Simulator's marketplace for this stuff.
Yes, that's good.
Did you get the JFK from there, or you got it directly with INI?
No, I got it from INI, yeah. But yeah. You're right, I should buy more from the marketplace. But
it's easy.
I still don't find it. The UI overly friendly is.
I can't work out whether I've installed it half the time.
Yeah, exactly. I still think the UI is not 100% there, but they're doing updates and it's looking great. So.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. Yeah. I'll probably have to get that JFK because I've done. I think I've flown into JFK on stream. I certainly flew out of it in Concorde. You didn't see that, did you?
I didn't.
So.
Oh, that's right. When the Concorde comes out on Microsoft Flight, there's going to be so many Concorde suggestions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you bet. Because it was an X-Plane 12 with the Connemata. And it was all going great. We got it powered up from cold and dark, taxied out. And an X-Plane default scenery is very good. It doesn't look amazing. It's not full of eye candy, but it's accurate with taxi stands and so on because of that amazing resource they've got with their... I've forgotten the name now, but community members build these airports.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic. Because some of the default airports in Microsoft Flight Simulator are shocking. They are so empty and incorrect and hard to use. Whereas in X-Plane, that doesn't tend to happen, even if they don't tend to look as nice when they're fully done. You know what I mean? But in general, they're quite reliable. But yeah, we taxied out and then I took off and... did the Concorde sort of departure, a big left turn, and didn't get the fuel trim sorted out for flight mode quick enough.
Right.
And as we accelerated, totally lost control. And it,
oh, no.
Yeah, just nosedived down like a lawn dart. It's terrible. It was, it was because the flight engineer in the real aircraft would have been trimming the fuel out for flight, and I didn't get around to that in time. I was busy focusing on flying the aeroplane, but that fuel trim is just as important, it turns out.
Wow, of course, that's interesting.
There's no such thing as fuel trimming in the 320. You might have a bit of an imbalance, but that's about it. And even on heavy long-haul aircraft these days, it's not as critical as it was in Concorde, where the center of gravity had to be shifted around so much to keep it stable for flight. It's an interesting thought. I mean, can you imagine the failures checklists they must have had for if a fuel pump wasn't working and you couldn't get fuel from one tank to the other. Imagine if I'm not saying Concorde had this issue, but imagine if you're flying along and you can't get the fuel to move. So your CG is set and you're at Mach 2 and then you can't slow down. It'd be like that film Speed, wouldn't it? Like where you're stuck at about 50 miles an hour.
Yeah. that's brilliant.
It's amazing. And I know that on the 747, they have trim tanks in the tail, but those pumps could fail. So you've sent fuel to the rear of the aircraft to trim it out for a more efficient flight. But then what if you can't get it back? Suddenly you realize it's not working back. So then you have to divert on what is effectively the minimum amount of fuel because you can't access a load of your fuel. It's stuck in the tail. Amazing stuff that can happen, isn't it? All plans. I want to be very clear. Like this is not stuff that is my whole thing about Concorde was purely hypothetical. I'm sure that there was systems in place to make sure that couldn't happen.
Yeah.
And with the 747 example there, they would have enough fuel to get to an alternate. That was the whole point. But you had to be ready for that situation. All of these things have to be considered, and they are, and that's the point. But it is an amazing thought, that an extra level of complication we don't have on short-haul 320 aircraft.
Yeah, it's a really good point.
And there we go. More things coming out soon. We've got the Bluebird 757. Well, I say coming out soon. Bluebird 757 has been up. There's been another little update. They've shown some more of the systems and the flight controls.
Yeah, it did look good.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, 757, all-time favourite of mine, and it's going to feature heavily when it comes out, no doubt. I don't know how close it is, though. I feel like it's... I don't know. Hard to tell. But I'm looking forward to it a lot.
Yeah. I'm really excited by it, but I the problem with it is I'd almost rather, like, I really like the way a week ago they came out and said, we've done JFK, it looks here really it good, this is it, and then a week later, boom, there you go, you have it. I find these teasers almost a bit frustrating, because you're like, well, where are we at? Are you 50% of the way there? Are we talking a year away? Are we talking 2 years away? I don't know.
They never say, and I can understand why. And I imagine there has to be a certain part of, you have to release some information just to keep your business going, i.e. keep interest there and keep your market demand and so on. But yeah, it's tricky to, because we want it right now, don't we? Because we're flight simmers and we love it, so we're just we have to just be patient here. It'll be here before you know it, like all these things, you know. Flight Simulator was, oh, when's it coming, oh, here's a release date, wow, and suddenly we've had it for 3 years. You know,
exactly, yeah. But what's amazing is we haven't actually had many study level or high detailed add-ons.
No,
and that's
I
quite
know.
Crazy, really. You would have thought there'd be more by now. And I think there's a big fat big developer on the doing the 330, and
Aerosol 330
been coming for years.
That's still on the way.
And I thought it was very odd the way they pulled the Twin Otter. But
so I heard about this. Yeah, that was so the Twin Otter is no longer available for Microsoft Flight Simulator, but it will be coming later
pulled
in
it
a
off
package.
Market, yeah.
How
which
strange.
Does annoy me, because I bought that and I was like, hang on a minute, it was quite expensive at the time and it was sold as this really like good Twin Otter, but hey ho.
I wonder what's happening with that. Yeah, we'll see. They said it might come back in a different form but not on its own.
Interesting.
I wonder what their plan is for that. Because A330, which would be an interesting aircraft, no doubt, to have, and is directly related to the 320 in the very most immediate sense. So should fit nicely straight onto
any Airbus
pilot's hangar. So that's looking good. I'm looking forward to that. But 757, I'd love to see. I think this is where the INI A310 fit in so well. It was great to get a retro complex airliner out and to do it for free, which is fantastic. And the 757 is going to be the Boeing sort of, it's a little bit, it's newer than the A310, isn't it? But it's still a previous generation sort of airliner. So it's nice to have that.
Yes.
When
we need
see
a long haul Boeing, I think.
And you want, so PMDG surely are bringing the triple at some point, but we've got no clue as to when.
Yeah, I think once again that seems to be, there's a lot of talk, but
they're keeping it under wraps for now,
I suppose.
Yeah.
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 Which is quite interesting.
We'll wait and see, because I love their 737, so I've no doubt the triple will be a nice machine when it arrives.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it'd be absolutely lovely. Yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to watch this video, which is from Big Jet TV, and it's from the first sort of really windy day we had in the UK here for this year.
Yeah.
Normally there's been a few storms by this point, and Big Jet TV usually gets onto the news with some great footage of airliners landing.
But this year,
not been so much, which has been great news for us as pilots. So we're starting the video at the 1 minute moment. So you ready, Barney?
Yes.
Okay, press play. Three, two, one. So it's 767. I think that's a 400. No, it's not.
No, it's 300 because it's got the winglets.
And it's rocking and rolling down in the wind and the rain. Quite nose low. Wings shaking around.
I find the gear so strange.
The way the gear tilt forward on the 767.
Yeah.
It's into the flare. There's close to touching down. Yeah. And up it goes again. Fantastic. And it roars away. water streaming off the wings, so clearly in the middle of a downpour. And the big giveaway is the wheels stay down. And you see some huge pitch changes as it climbs away as well.
Yeah.
Quite amazing.
Absolutely. It's incredible.
Those are all signs that it was a wind shear go around, i.e. they left the wheels out because they were experiencing wind shear. Yeah.
No, that's really interesting, isn't it? Wow.
It's a good clip. So
there has been a fair few storms this last week or so. Me, it's quite exciting. She's like, that's the professionalism at work. That's what we're trained to do. Those pilots are doing their jobs bloody well, from what I can see.
Yeah.
They made the right decision based on my armchair opinion right now. But I'm really impressed with that.
Yeah. It's quite something, isn't it?
You can always go around. You can always go around.
Yeah, quite. Absolutely. It's amazing the power of that machine, that it can just heave itself with the gear out, the flaps are maybe full. I don't know what they were landing with, but, you know, a lot of flap out, a lot of drag, and it can heave itself right back up into the air. It's fantastic. Really.
Yes, absolutely really good. Brilliant.
And it's worth noting, of course, that, well, I don't know the exact rules, but most of these aircraft can do that on one engine as well. Certainly initially.
Yes.
They might struggle without the gear down, but there you go. And away it goes.
That is fantastic.
It's funny, so Big Jet TV did several videos. So if you go to their YouTube channel, you'll see their clips from that day, Storm Noah it was, which, like I say, is the only sort of the first wind we've had this year. Normally it comes earlier in the year. Talking earlier about judging pilots and so on, it came up in one of those clips. and I really like Big Jet TV, love the enthusiasm, love the content and the commitment to aviation. He's standing there in awful conditions, making sure we get to enjoy the spectacular sight of these machines doing what they do, which is great. But yeah, it's hard not to, when you watch landings all day, start thinking some are better than others and thinking that some things are being handled worse or better, just judging from the outside. And as we were saying earlier, so important that you just have to appreciate you can't tell the differences. You haven't got enough information watching from the outside to really be able to judge any of that stuff to any reasonable level of certainty. If it looks like a plane is moving around more than another one, it could just be the conditions were worse at that time. It could be that airplane has a slight issue with some of the roll spoilers, or it could be that there was a wind shear at that moment. It's just so hard. So many things that could be going on. And it could be a different airplane. A Neo, for example, I've said this before, a Neo in the wind moves around more, I find, than a CEO, because it approaches at a slower airspeed and the engines are spooling up a little bit later, and the ground speed mini is much
bigger
less
as well.
Engines.
The bigger engines cause a lot more drag as well.
Yeah. So there you go. So if you watch the 320 CEO land and in exactly the same conditions in Neo, they would look different. And one, the Neo would probably look worse, but it's not actually worse. It's just handling the conditions differently. I'm determined to be an advocate for not judging judging things.
No,
that's so true. Yeah, I think it's so important. But love the enthusiasm of Big Jet TV. Love them standing there filming that stuff. And that's a great, great wind shear go around to get on video.
Definitely.
I'm going to ask you a couple of questions now about wind.
About wind, okay.
Yeah. So when you get windy days like this, and this is probably enough of a topic for a podcast on its own, because the weather is one of those things that really does affect our day more than most weather and technical issues. So if you had, let's say you were on approach and I said to you, 20 knots across, it's now a 20 knot crosswind. How does that make you feel?
I'm like, okay, I can. That's doable, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, now it's 30 knots. Gusting to 20, gusting 30 knots. How does that make you feel?
It's just increased suddenly.
Yeah, is that what you're saying? As you're flying down, I'm just... not so much the increase, but just... I just want to get your emotional reaction to those numbers.
Okay, that's all right. Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah, 20 to 30. Okay. Now it's 30 gusting 35.
That was a bit breezy, but I'd like to think that past Barney would have put fuel on and taken enough fuel to go around and try it again. Yeah. So yeah.
As you go into sort of the above 20 knots, you're sort of thinking extra fuel, aren't you? It's quite seems to be a common sort of area. Okay, and now it's maybe it's not a full crosswind. It's slightly like sort of a crosswind from the left, but not straight across the runway. But it's 35 gusting 45.
Yeah, once again, the fuel thing. I'd probably be thinking, right, if I wind shear it, what's the wind shear maneuver? Mm-hmm. How do I go around? Probably mini brief it with my colleague.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd be like, we trained to do it. I can do it. Yeah.
Go down and see. And if it doesn't work, hopefully you've got somewhere where it's more down the runway.
Exactly.
What if I said it's 40 knots down the runway?
That's right. If it's smooth, constant, it's just you just don't have to flare as much. So just let the wind do the work for you. But it's generally all right. Yeah. If it's gusty, sunny, then it becomes a bit more challenging.
It's that 40 knots barrier is such a big, I don't know, in my mind, 40 knots is like, that's where it's pretty. Yeah. 40 knots is like, we need a plan. We need a really solid plan B and C.
Yes.
Even when we start that approach, I need to know where I can go afterwards and how, and I need to have the fuel to go and do that. Whereas down in the 20s and 30s, it feels very different. It's funny, isn't it? Even though that's just a preconception. Because, of course, you can go somewhere. Yeah. You can go somewhere like Keflavik, and it can be 40 knots there and totally smooth. You wouldn't even know. Passengers wouldn't even know it's windy, because there's just, if it's coming from over the sea, comes in smooth, straight over the runway, straight down the runway, and you land, and you wouldn't even know. But you go somewhere with terrain around and you do 40 knots, even if it's down the runway, and you're going to feel it.
you're right.
But yeah, I was just curious to run those numbers by you, because it's...
it's really interesting.
As we sort of escalate it, you get above 40 and it's quite a thing. And in Storm Noah, it reached 40 knots. So those pilots were dealing with pretty windy conditions. And once you start going above, if you get to 50, then no one's moving. I have landed in 50 knots down the runway before. I think it was gusting 55 once.
Yeah.
Not a common occurrence. But again, if it's from the right direction, you can do it.
It's not something you want to be doing.
It's not a fun day out. It's very focused situation. And the other problem, of course, is if the wind reaches 55 knots or whatever, it doesn't have to be very far off the angle of the runway before the crosswind limit's out of limits. And this is the problem with strong winds. If you've got a crosswind that's 35 knots, that's fine, right? That's within limits. Airbus typically, you know, you're looking at sort of 35 to 40 knot crosswind limits, somewhere around there of most of these sort of big aircraft, big jet airliners. But the problem with that is that wind had better be perfectly across, because if it shifts 10 degrees to be a slight tailwind at 40 knots, then that's probably putting you right up on your tailwind limit straight away. And I've had that before as well.
Definitely.
And that can get pretty awkward pretty quickly. But
you're right about that.
I noticed in that video as well, one of the big jet videos, he points at the camera at the windsock and says, look at the windsock, and it's sort of straight across. But I don't find windsocks useful above 20 knots. They just sit there straight across whatever you look at.
Yeah, because you're not looking at them at all. It's what the tower says to you. That's the critical bit.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. The windsocks, they sort of go, they sort of pick up to sort of 20 knots, and then they're just sort of horizontal from that point onwards. But they do give you a clue. If you're sitting on the ground, you can watch them for your own amusement. I think of all the pilots trying to land.
Exactly, yeah. But you're right about that.
So that's it then. So we'll leave it there for today. So thank you very much for taking the time once again. And
that's right, I did enjoy it. Thank you so much.
Look forward to having you back on board again soon.
Carry
on. Got loads more questions to get through. Loads more. And hopefully some guests, which I'm sure you'll be
enjoying it.
Interested to talk to. Yeah, we had lots of really great feedback again for the last episode. So thank you to anyone who's messaged and emailed questions in and so on. It's really really appreciated, and we look forward to answering more of them in another episode. So Thanks very much, Barney. Definitely. Have a good rest of the day.
No worries. Look forward to the next time. Thank you.
Cheers. Bye bye.
That's it for this episode of From Flight Level 320. Thank you so much for listening. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you for spreading the word about the podcast. It's enabled us to secure our first guest on the show, aside from Barney. The next episode will feature a really fantastic guest. It is the one and only Katie Pilot. Katie Pilot is a real-world airline pilot, a content creator and streamer, and a developer of certain parts of flight simulation add-ons. So a really, really fascinating guest who has very kindly taken the time to talk with us. And so in the next episode, we'll be having a big discussion with Katie Pilot all about flight simulation and aviation. Do please keep spreading the word and, of course, send your questions to simpilot320@hotmail.com or join the 320 SimPilot Discord where you can find us on podcast questions. We'll see you again in another video or live stream or podcast, so do please keep safe and well. Bye-bye.